This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel like
some opportunity for people in the audience to a substantial amount of time for people in the audience to interact with the panel. So, if you don't mind, I'm kind of going to go straight to that. But hang on just a minute. I think you can see a real spectrum of views here, all the way from Tom, who's kind of over on the admitted idea is a good idea side, over to Rob, who thinks it's relatively destructive and not very helpful. In between, you have Alex and Ruth, who lean one way or the other, but whose understanding is much more nuanced and much less definite. They're not so sure about some things. And I found it very refreshing when I read their papers. I don't know how you felt, but I found it very refreshing because that kind of mirrors a lot of people in this room out there. So somewhere on that spectrum you find yourself. So what I want to do is hope to distribute. I would like to address questions to a specific panelist, although not only that panelist might have a comment, but I'd like to try to spread them out also over the kind of range that we have here.
Can you say a little bit why irreducible complexity, because you mentioned it but you went over it, is not correct? Because if it's falsifiable, then I would have thought that was evidence that it was science. So I'd be interested if you could say why.
The question was, is just asking a bit more about irreducible complexity, because if it is falsifiable, that makes it science. I'll point out I was a bit vague on whether I think ID is science. I think that's not the most important question. I think it is falsifiable. I think there is every possibility that one of these mini-machines that might be he talks about, or the complement cascade, things like that, not complement cascade, it was blood clotting cascade, could have evolved by an evolutionary pathway. I think there's a massive amount of uncharted territory in biology. We're only just scratching the surface. And I think the deeper we go, the more likely it gets that we find this out. Now, some of those explanations for how something might have evolved do sound speculative. There are other explanations, but I'm unfortunately I'm not a cell biologist. But my conviction that macroevolution, can I go on a tangent? Is that allowed? My conviction that macro.
Depends on how far. I'll try to
okay. Try all right. You can tell me to shut up if you want. My conviction that macroevolution happened is based upon the evidence we see in the genome when we compare the DNA of different species. The whole thing is like a complicated tapestry, or my favourite analogy is like knitting patterns. Okay, bear with me. Knitting's trendy now. Okay, so we've got a Hollywood star doing their knitting in between shots on the set, and they've got their knitting pattern, okay, and then they pass it on to somebody else. They think, oh, no, we don't want it like this. They change it a little, pass it on, change a little, and soon you've got this knitting pattern that's been photocopied and passed around, all with its various alterations, all over Hollywood, all right? Okay, now I get interested in Hollywood knitting patterns, and I collect them all up, and I compare them all, and I find there are some similarities between some of them, some differences between others, and I can arrange them in a branching tree of similarities. Okay, so and it's very clear those patterns, and that's what we see in the genome. Now, not all of those changes are cause a function, so you can't always point a finger and say God just made it that way. We know by bitter experience in the lab sometimes that when you change something in the genome, it doesn't always have a functional effect. So that's the basis on which I think macroevolution probably. There is good evidence for it.
Thank you.
Yes.
We need to hear this louder.
Why don't you say the question without the mic, and then we'll give it to them to repeat it.
It strikes me, Ruth, that the example you've used there isn't an example of an evolutionary process at all. It is, in fact, an example of a design process. Because what you're saying is that patterns being handed on to individuals, and each individually has volitionally altered the pattern. They've done it for their own purpose. It hasn't happened blindly or because of something inherent in the pattern itself. So I
failed
to see why that's a good example.
I respond to that. Yeah, no, that's where the analogy does break down. Okay, so you can't take an analogy too far. Can I just qualify what I said? So what the changes I'm talking about that happen between knitting patterns or between genomes are mutations, they're rearrangements. Can I use the whiteboard? Is that loud? I'll try not to take too long. So you've got, if you have a crossing over, this is a chromosome, all right. A crossing over event that happens during the process of meiosis, which is what happens when we produce sperm and eggs. So the chromosomes cross over. This might look a bit familiar to those of you who did biology at school. Here, mutations can quite easily happen. This is actually an exchange of DNA between two identical portions of the same chromosome. Now, if there's a slippage in the mechanism by which the two chromosomes separate, you can get a duplication event. And that's just one example of a random mutation event that can happen. So these are the random events that I mean when I...
So I'm going to repeat the question after the fact, which was that doesn't the example of using a handed-on knitting pattern, in fact, speak more of design than of a random mutation type of building process? And Ruth says no and gave her answer. Okay. Next.
I'll address this to Dr. Wood. You addressed the above origination.
If I had had more time, I might have, you know.
Say the question.
Okay, I'm sorry. Would I bring out the significance of the recently, I mean, within the last 3 years, released MIT book, Origination of Organismal Form? I see this as the development, the first sign of the development of a new naturalistic paradigm apart from Darwinian evolution. And the 20 scholars that met about 7 years ago outside of Vienna, Austria, include Simon Conway Morris of Cambridge University, who's well known in this work in the Cambrian strata. And this book, in the opening chapter by Gerd Müller and Stuart Newman, indicates that the neo-Darwinian paradigm has run out of gas. I mean, that's my words. It's not their words. I'm trying to say they indicate that the gene focus, the Darwinian traditional gene focus, has proved itself unable to explain the arising of new form, new morphology. And therefore, we are looking for new mechanisms, they say, natural mechanisms, to explain how, for example, the phyla arise, and then classes within phyla. And I see this as and I think it's fair to use the word, devastating assessment of the current paradigm. One of my arguments is that ID would never have any gas in it whatsoever if the current paradigm were fully plausible, fully robust, and showing how new morphology is arising on a regular matter, and how 20,000 genes on the upper-level mammalian genome, 20,000 genes are written. I mean, if 250 genes in a parasitic animal is irreducibly complex, that's just 250 genes. How about 20,000 genes? I mean, what mechanistic process is writing the script for these 20,000 genes? I have yet to see any evidence that we have from science that a genuinely novel gene has ever been seen, in experimental evidence, has ever been seen as having written by natural processes. And I would love to hear if there is such evidence, you know. So,
Can I respond to that?
Sure. Yeah.
I just want to respond to that to say I agree. partly because in my PhD, I worked on an epigenetic mechanism. To me, that's exciting, moving on in our understanding that non-changes that are not to do with DNA changes and sequence mutations contribute to changes in organisms' form and function. That, to me, doesn't mean evolution could not have happened. It just means we need to work harder at figuring out the mechanism. And I think this, to me, is if I can say, the difference between the two kinds of arguments that I think John Lennox brought out this morning. Sorry, I keep quoting you. That was okay. We talked about two different kinds of gaps. There was the kind of gap which is to do with the anthropic principle and things like that, which look at a lot more certain, the kind of gap that we can it be closed? It looks as if it probably won't be able to. And they're the kind of gaps that science may well be able to close. And I think when we mix the two up, that's when the waters get very muddy. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at, is to say that we need to identify the kind of gaps that won't close. And I think those kind of gaps are the kinds that atheists point out, like Fred Hoyle. He was quite happy to. He was very upset with the Big Bang, but he accepted the evidence for it.
Just a second. I think Peter had his hand up earlier.
Go ahead and ask the question.
Okay, so it's a question really for Rob and Ruth, which is, as I hear the panel, I hear four people who are in favour of ID. Because it seems to me, okay, you may have different positions on the question of evolution, but you're all at different points just as to how you would articulate intelligent design, and that one can, you know, support full evolution and be an ID advocate. I heard Ruth at the end of the paper say something about the possibility of the information having been there in the beginning that would sort of lead to what we've got now. Now that would that can happen within either a Calvinist or even in an Arminian framework of God with formful knowledge setting up a set of things which he knew would inevitably lead to take away without any of the properties of the chemicals in the universe actually inevitably leading where it's the sort of choice of arrangement of things. So that would be a perfectly fine ID variation. I hear Rob saying something slightly different because he's possibly talking about the properties of chemicals inevitably leading to something. But again, that still might be an ID position. I just wonder how you'd respond to that later.
That's a long question to respond.
That's a long question.
Maybe you can summarise this question.
Can I summarise the question to say, was the information in the universe at its origin, and how did it then?
Well, can you explain why that isn't an ID position?
I think it is an ID position. I think perhaps I can just say, I think I made it clear that there are some aspects of what you are now calling intelligent design, which I agree with. I agree that God created the universe. And I'm tending towards the view that the origin of life is difficult to explain other than by God having done it as a special event. But the reason I talked about ID as evolution is because in the public mind, ID has, and because of the dispute in the States about teaching of evolution in schools, ID has come to mean just evolution is wrong, as opposed to all the other aspects that you're talking about. In the public press, ID equals evolution, and that's the point at which I depart from agreeing with Tom. There's much more that we agree about than what we disagree about, actually. And as I said, some of the things I'm tending towards about the origin of life and the origin of the universe are intelligent design. I think I might not use those words, but I think, you know, they show the fingerprints of God.
So you're not a neo-Darwinian?
I would call myself a theistic evolutionist, I think.
Yeah, can I add to that? I think the reason that Christian biologists will not call themselves not associate with the intelligent design movement is because of the controversies that I talked about when it with the anti-evolution arguments, that evolution couldn't have happened, macroevolution couldn't have happened, irreducible complexity. And I've got a lot of colleagues. I'm just a baby biologist. but there are a lot of, I have a lot of very senior biologist colleagues in Cambridge who, Bible-believing Christians, evangelical Christians, who wouldn't associate themselves with the ID movement for that reason. So maybe we need to think of a new word.
You're for ID people with different tactics.
So I think I hear both Ruth and Rob saying that they have some strong cultural reasons for wanting to distance themselves from the language, especially the language of the ID movement, because of some cultural issues that they're facing. If I'm hearing you right, that's one strong element of... anyone have a question for Alex? Okay, Avilo.
So the question was whether the irreducible complexity of life would break down if there would be if we found a new organism with less genes. And of course, I think it's not a matter of how many genes there are necessary. It could be hundreds, it could be 50, it could be 10. But as soon as we realize that we get into a region where chance and necessity, just by simple successing steps, would be able to produce life, then the theory would have to be corrected probably. But as long as we have such a huge gap of 250 genes, and that's really the most optimistic guess, I think there is still good reason to take a working hypothesis, and the working hypothesis is life is irreducibly complex. Of course, if it can be shown that life can also exist already with only one or two genes, or if a mechanism is found by which genes can slowly build themselves up into the necessary components, that would be refuted, I think.
Thank you. Art in the back there?
I just had a small question for Alex Fink. I'm a little surprised you took the Urialum example. Presumably you're speaking about his paper in 2003, Nature, Evolution as an Engineer, which is a play on the François Jacob 1973 paper on evolution as a tinkerer. But the whole point of that article, I thought, was to argue that the motifs that you see in these gene networks are there because of evolution, not the other way around. So could you explain to me again, that was the thrust of the article. You've somehow turned it around, and I don't really understand how you could turn it around.
Question was about the Uri Alon paper that I mentioned, and Art Lewis said that I turned the conclusion around. Of course, it was a naturalistic paper, and they tried to found these different properties like modularity and different other properties that you also find in engineered systems. And then the conclusion was, in the end, in the last passage, that we should discover or analyze the natural laws which are responsible for evolved and created systems. And then I just said, of course, if I'm a naturalist, that's the only way I can think. I need to find the common natural laws that underlie our engineering and that underlie evolution. But I think when I come as a Christian, I can also ask the question, maybe we can see and we know how engineers work. They take a plan and then they construct their machine, for example. And that's what we know and what we understand. But we don't understand how modularity in the gene networks has arisen in nature. We are still looking for it. So why can't we turn the question around and ask, is there an engineer behind the genome? For example, I think that's a valid question and we could ask it. We don't only have to focus our search for the natural laws that force evolution to develop like that and that force engineers to build their machines like that. I think it's again the question of bottom-up and top-down action. And the question is whether both systems actually arise due to bottom-up action or whether it's top-down action.
Just curiosity,
Tom would like to comment.
Go ahead.
I'm just curious if you have actually read the rest of Malone's work.
Yes, I have. Well, not all of his papers. I have read the paper in itself.
Because that's just a little comment on this body of work, which is part of a larger body of work of lots of people.
Of course, yeah.
Well, I think and you guys should talk about this in the hall, you two, about this particular body of work. Because the rest of us don't know anything about it.
Well, let me just... Can I
ask a question before I... Yeah. How many people in this audience are working in evolutionary biology in the way, such as one, are currently working in evolutionary biology?
Okay. Let me just.
That's too specialist then. That's too specialist in the topic.
I think it sounds like an interesting discussion, but I don't know that anyone's going to follow it besides you two guys, so that's why I'm suggesting that.
Let me just make this quick comment, because the whole idea of engineering, recognizing engineering attributes of these systems, or that give the appearance of an engineered system, this in the new chapter of Michael Behe, he feels that the burden of proof is on evolutionary biology, that when you see systems that Dawkins himself says, the study of biology of complicated things that appear to have been designed, and then later in his book, Blind Watchmaker says that this impression is overwhelming. And Crick says you have to, the biologist must constantly remind himself that this was not designed. No, you can imagine the biologist muttering, it wasn't designed, it wasn't designed, it wasn't designed. And, you know, and when we hear comments, these are not, I mean, these are almost unguarded comments. They're just honestly sharing their impression of the biological world. And what Steve Meyer's trying to bring to the table is that when you use the most powerful method in science today, what I understand is becoming universally recognized, one of the most powerful methods. It's called inference to the best explanation. And if you have mutually exclusive categories of explanation, and if the cause-effect structure of our universe is that intelligent agents easily produce massive amounts of complexity, specified complexity, that is what I think undergirds the design inference. And it's not, you know, I think I read in one of the papers, I don't know, it looks too complex to me, you know, and therefore it must have been designed. Well, that's a caricature. That's not the way the design inference works. It's through a careful evaluation to see if a law or a combination of chance and law could have explained it. And only as a last recourse, through the explanatory filter, only as a final recourse do we turn to the possibility, the sheer possibility of design. And I think that's a better understanding of how the design inference works. Thanks for letting me jump on that.
I suppose this might be unfair for the chair to say anything, but I'm a physicist of 40 years of physics, and I'm trying to understand all this. I'm not a biologist, but I am a physicist. And so I try to read stuff. And I recently read a paper by Jonathan Wells in an Italian journal. It's in an Italian journal because of the simple bias in the American journals. It's a 25-page paper investigating some molecular machines in cells called centrioles. There are two of them at right angles. They rotate. And they have a lot to do with mitosis. And I was reading this paper, this 25-page paper, and at least there's enough physics in it that I can understand it because it's about these little molecular machines. I would recommend you read that paper and ask yourself, because Wells' point at the beginning in the abstract is that the design paradigm greatly encourages and furthers you to figure out what this machine is doing if you start by assuming it's a machine. So the question of whether the design paradigm has any outcomes in research, I think anyone who wants to wrestle with that question should at least wrestle with that Jonathan Wells paper. Actually, was directed to it by talking to Jonathan when I bumped into him in a meeting and asking him if there was any predictive ability in the design paradigm. So I think a person should read that article. It's not that, I mean, you won't follow all the footnotes, but you can follow the thread of it and take a look at what he's done and see if you think he has made any progress in establishing his point that the design paradigm actually has predictive value. If you need that reference, I can give it to you. I actually have it on my memory stick, the article, as a PDF. So if anyone's really interested, I can help. I'm not telling you where I stand on this at all by saying this. I'm reading stuff so I can try to understand it. But I have to tell you that as I was reading that article, I'm saying, like, And they say ID isn't science? You know, I mean, I had that kind of a response to the... Now, whether he proves his philosophical point is one thing, but whether he understands the system properly, I felt that he was probably analyzing the system in a good way, the system he was working on. So that's... Sorry about that. That's kind of illegal for me to say anything. But next question would be for who? Let's see. Wait a second. This gentleman here had his hand up. Well, yeah.
I suppose a question probably more for Tom and Alex. It sounds to me, from what I've been hearing, that the devil is very much in the details, and that there's a lot of back and forth. Whatever the bacterial flagellum situation, it is just one example, albeit maybe a substantiated or relatively well substantiated example. But rather than clinging tightly for potentially theological reasons to a genuine desire to sort of, as Ruth describes, sort of find God in the answer. Would it be better just to hold back and to hold on to these things tightly and to let the scientific work happen over a period of time, maybe a decade, I don't know, maybe 2 decades. I don't know how long it takes for these things to work themselves through the system. But rather than leaping onto it and holding onto it tightly, wouldn't it be better just to hold on to them tentatively and see how they work out? And if there is something genuine there, in 10 years, 20 years' time, maybe people are going to look back and say, yes, that's where it began.
So the question is that right now there are a lot of details that need to be clarified with regard to intelligent design. And so whether it wouldn't be better to wait and see what happens in 10 years, whether some ideas worked out or didn't work out. Well, I think that's what's happening since 1996, as Tom was mentioning. And up to now, I think it works out in some areas, but there are still very many open questions. And you're right. I would also say it's just competing hypotheses, and you should test all of them. And about the theology, I think there is a value in these questions, or there is a value in poking holes in evolution, as you said, because I think... As an atheist, you only have one option, and that one option is evolution. You have no other chance how life and we could have arisen. So if it's possible to show that evolution is not sufficiently to show how we arose, then I think that's a good point of connection to materialist people who need to think, well, what happened then? And so I think it's at least a plausibility argument. What do you really think when you start to think, what do you think, is that plausible, that evolution led to this thing? So I think there is a...
And I would say that if, for example, just picking the flagellum example, there has been a period. It's, if you check the history of this whole discussion, it didn't begin with Michael Behe. If you go to Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, published in Great Britain in 1985, in the chapter Bridging the Gaps, Michael Denton spends, I think, about a page and a half discussing the flagellum. And then he spends another page or so discussing the psyllium. And then he goes on to about, I don't think, 15 or 18 other systems, just in one chapter, that to him appear not to have any plausible intermediary path to develop that new organ or that radically different organ. So if we give, let's say, 11 years, and of course Behe read at Denton in 1987, I think it was converted overnight to a skeptic of dark macroevolution, or at least nature-driven macroevolution. And then it was another 8 years until he produced his theory. Another 10 years has passed since then, but a year after Behe's theory was published, Ralph Seelke, professor of biology at University of Wisconsin, began his own laboratory testing of Behe's theory, and his results for 9 years, published in many different journals, have radically, I think, confirmed using 1, 2, 3, and 4 mutation knockouts on a system that produces tryptophan. He's confirmed Behe's theory. Now, if Behe hadn't published his book in 1996, then Ralph Seelke wouldn't have jumped on it as an experimentalist and begun his publication, his experimental validation. And I think that shows, again, the robustness of this whole line of thought in trying to bring some clarity and some completeness to this new mode of thought, and then a way to test it.
Tom, so, did you want? What is Denton's worldview commitment? Denton.
At the time, he was an agnostic, raised in a Plymouth Brethren home in England, but he was an agnostic. He's become, I think, Aristotelian deist or something like that since then. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
Can I throw a question? Is that allowed? I'm just curious to find out. I've heard this question asked, but I've never heard a reply. How ID deals with the theodicy question. Okay, we're getting into theology, but so we've got a bacterial flagellum that's been designed to make this bacteria more virulent. So how do we deal then with a God who's made a very effective bacterium? Is that a fair question?
ID is a minimalist theory. We have no theological point of view. That's supposed to be funny, by the way. I'm not very good as a stand-up comic. But Bill Dembski has talked quite a bit. That's a very good question. It's the appropriate question for the setting, to be sure. And Bill Dembski has said we, on purpose, have just laid that question to one side because it is more of a theological. It deals with the moral, you know, the problem of suffering and moral issues, values such as that. I think that Dembski has announced in his book, The Design Revolution, his plan to write a whole book on that topic and maybe work with some other scholars. As a Christian, Dembski believes that the fall is figured in, factored in somehow. And even Minnick, as Minnick was developing his research to show that the flagellum degraded into the type 3 secretory system, Minnick asked the same question. He was wondering, how did this happen? What did God permit? Did God, you know, make it? And we don't know. And I think these are important questions. These are follow-up questions that the Christian community can and should deal with.
Do I see an example of fine-tuning? I'm seeing a hand waving over in the back. I think Ard can answer that question a lot more well than I can. Can I have
it? I think we have no idea, but I run together beside Colleen Morris, one of my colleagues in Cambridge, and Jonathan Dorn, another of my colleagues. We ran a large program on fine-tuning in biology. We asked people to write half $3 million we handed out for research on this topic. And I think it's an interesting question, is something fine-tuning. I think it's probably too early to ask. It's too difficult of a question. We still know enough about biology.
That would be what I would say. And I think it's therefore not too wise to pull too hard on any direction. I think that's what we saw with the kind of grant proposals we got in. That they're interesting ideas, but nothing that really had any real traction. Nothing. I mean, in some sense, biology is. If you're used to physics, you'd say biology is instilled in a pre-Newtonian era, in that sense. And if you're going to try to do fine-tuning or all of these kinds of complicated things, and you want to make big arguments about them, you have to somehow be able to close off all other possibilities. That would be like trying to make fine-tuning arguments about the universe in a pre-Newtonian time. I don't think that's possible.
Would Simon Conway Morris regard his notion that if you rewind the tape of evolution, you get the same thing, so there's some kind of directedness or teleology in it, as a kind of fine-tuning, do you think?
I don't want to speak... I don't want to speak for Simon. I think that one of the real difficulties with this whole thing is ID, fine-tuning, those are extremely vaguely used words, and we use them all the time. So I think he wouldn't use... I don't think the word fine-tuning is actually correct in biology. I think that's not something which is really the right way to look at it. It doesn't mean that you can't extract teleology from fine-tuning. I should also point out that Simon thinks he does extract some kind of teleology, but he holds it very lightly. That's the way he would think. I think that's all that you can really say. I think it's just far too early, and I think we make fools of ourselves if we try to say things that we don't know very much about.
I think Alex, who has his feet in two camps, might be able to respond to that, whether there's any fine-tuning biology.
I think that, of course, the fine-tuning in biology will be different from the fine-tuning in cosmology, because in cosmology you have some constants and you plug the constants into the Einstein equation of general relativity, and then you get the universe, so to say. So it's just... it's that easy for theoretical physicists, actually. But it's always numbers, and you plug them into an equation. But in biology, we don't have an equation by which you, where you can fine-tune any constants. Well, I could think of some mechanisms which should be fine-tuned, like the number of mutations per gene site, for example, and how many happen there, for example. If there are too many, then the organism will die because too many mutations would cause deleterious mutations and so on. And other questions are, how can the mechanisms of biology produce the requirements for life? Like, how can DNA arise, for example? Or how can these complex machines arise? And of course, there is a certain way of fine-tuning, but it's not a fine-tuning of numbers, but it's rather engineering, actually. It's function and engineering, yeah.
Marge is passing out the questionnaires, but we'll take one more question while she's doing that. Yeah, okay, Richard.
Here, you speak into the mic. Sure. It seems to me that the question we've been thinking about a lot in this session is the question, has design disproved neo-Darwinism? But I think the question should be, has neo-Darwinism disproved design? Because Darwin set up his whole thesis as a disproof of design in the natural world, and that's how Dawkins sets up the blind watchmaker. And most evolutionary biologists you speak to will admit that they have not been an evolutionist since they were born. At the beginning of their life, they didn't believe evolution, but they became convinced of it, and so they rejected design. So I think the question is, does neo-Darwinism provide a rigorous disproof of design? And I think that's how the general public sees this question, and they've been told that neo-Darwinism does disprove design. I think there should be more clarity on the part of evolutionary biologists about this question, because I agree with Ruth that in speaking with them in private and in lab meetings, there is a great deal of acknowledgement of what we can and can't explain and what the limitations of the theory are at the present time. But I just find that that doesn't filter through to the public. So, for example, it is a fact that we cannot posit a step-by-step incremental process by which the bacterial flagellum has evolved. Now, perhaps that will happen in the future, but it is a fact that at the moment we just have one intermediate, which is the type 3 secretory system. But the public get the impression that evolutionary biology has shown such a pathway. And I think that's where the problem is. And they should simply be told it's possible that evolution could find a pathway in the future, and evolutionary biologists believe that they will come up with such an explanation. But if you don't have the same confidence in the biologists that they have in themselves, then you might want to think about an alternative hypothesis for yourself. I think if we had that kind of clarity, and I speak myself as an evolutionary biologist, about the current limitations of the theory, then probably we wouldn't be having this discussion at the moment. I guess that's more of a comment than a question, but if you'd like to comment, that would be great.
I think, actually, the most important question is this a good apologetic argument, and would one use this if one was doing an apologetic talk? And I think, for me, it's definitely no.
Okay.
All right. I would just say one of the evidences of what Richard Buggs has just said is the recorded responses of both educated people and lay people to the film Unlocking the Mystery of Life. And I've recorded about 60 responses from wide-ranging divergent backgrounds and worldviews, and I have yet to receive any hostile response to that simple educational presentation.
Okay. As far as fine-tuning goes, you want to build a double helix. You better pick the electron charge right and the neutron-proton mass difference, or else you won't even form the compounds you have now. And that's what fine-tuning is about. It does have implications for biology. Anyway, thanks a lot for your attention. Panel, thank you very much.